Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
The wind blew hot and potent, filling the galley's sails and driving it across the surface of the choppy Mediterranean. There was no need for oars to move the ship, not with the wind blowing this hard. The Christian slaves chained to the galley's benches, where they pulled, ate, and slept, where they lived, were grateful for the respite. The galley's captain knew this wind well. He had known it all his life. The scirocco, they had called it in his fishing village south of Naples, and when the rain came with it, the droplets were tinged with red. Sand from the Sahara Desert, he knew now, but in his childhood it had seemed like magic. Not good magic, mind you, but the kind of dark magic that drove the corsairs north from their haunts in North Africa to steal captives from Italy. Captives like he had been, like his oarsmen were now. The captain's name was Hassan, and he was now nearly 50 years old, weathered and tanned by these winds and rain. Hassan had begun his life as a Christian, a native of the Amalfi Coast of Italy, but that was a long time ago. Still, this wind would always be a scirocco, at least in his head. He could never shed the language of his youth entirely. March was a bit early for a raid, heading north from Tripoli for the sea lanes off the coast of Sicily. But Hassan knew this wind, and he knew these waters. He had been raiding here all his life. His keen eyes picked out a smudge of white at the edge of the horizon. A ship. A prize. Prey. Hassan shouted orders. A whip cracked, and the enslaved rowers pulled and pulled and pulled. The white smudge got closer, close enough for Hassan to make out a bit of red and white on a banner. The ship he was hunting belonged to the Knights of St. John, the piratical holy warriors of Malta. Hassan had been fighting them all his life, too. He smiled. The old enemy once again. A worthy challenge and perhaps a profitable one. That was the life of a corsair, the life he had been given, or perhaps chosen, so long ago. It was how he had lived and how he would die. And if it were here, that would be the will of Allah. So be it. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. At long last, my friends, we've reached the end of our coverage of the early modern period. We'll have a few interviews coming up over the next several weeks, really good ones on a variety of topics that I think you'll enjoy. And after that, we're off to prehistory, to the very dawn of humanity, thinking about things like, where did we come from? How did we spread out all over the world? How did farming, trade, metalworking, cities, and states all come into being? These are just a few of the questions we'll try to ask and answer. I can't tell you how excited I am to delve into everything from Neanderthals to ancient Egypt to the Bronze Age collapse, and I hope you'll stick with us in the coming months. But before we head way, way back in time, we've got one final episode in the early modern period. One quick note here, I'm using Roger Crowley's wonderful narrative history, Empires of the Sea, throughout today's episode. So, last time on Tides, we started our discussion of the war that washed over the Mediterranean for most of the 16th century, the clash between the Habsburgs of Spain and the Ottoman Empire, which culminated in the Siege of Malta in 1565 and the Battle of Lepanto in 1571. To try to understand this conflict, we met two composite characters, Jean, a Hospitaller knight, a member of the Order of St. John, which was based on Malta, and Hassan, an Italian renegade who converted to Islam and became a corsair. Their paths crossed several times, at Tunis in 1535, at the Battle of Preveza in 1538, Algiers in 1541, and still more over the following decades, as constant violence engulfed the Mediterranean on an increasingly large scale. The violence took many forms. Its quotidian manifestations were slave raiding and piracy. Hassan led squadrons of galleys to steal captives from the shores of Italy, Sicily, and Spain, who would be put to work as rowers in the galleys or sold in the slave markets of Algiers. They lurked just out of sight over the horizon, slipping close to shore in the black of night before grabbing the unsuspecting villagers at dawn, then escaping back to the open sea. Jean was not averse to slaving himself, but he specialized in preying on the rich Muslim shipping of the Eastern Mediterranean. The Aegean was his favorite hunting ground, a place where he could seize a rich prize, maybe pilgrims heading from Istanbul to the holy cities of Mecca and Medina, and then dash off to hide along the Greek or Anatolian coastline. For his part, Hassan liked to prowl the Bay of Naples and the Straits of Messina, separating Sicily from the Italian mainland. Aragonese ships loaded down with fine cloth and rich noblemen to hold for ransom were his preferred targets. This kind of inflicted misery was just another part of Mediterranean life, the daily exchange that was both grounded and divided by commerce and religious war. Over the course of Hassan's and Jean's lives, the violence reached a fever pitch. More and more galleys knifed through the waters of the Mediterranean, participating in bigger and bloodier battles. The quantities of enslaved people stolen from the shores of Italy and Spain got larger and larger. Armies, navies, and ambitions all grew to previously unimagined scales. The climax finally arrived at Jean's adopted home of Malta in 1565, when an enormous Ottoman force came to finish off the Hospitallers once and for all. But why Malta? Truth be told, it was a desolate little place, a speck of rocky soil jutting out of the middle of the Mediterranean, just off the southeastern coast of Sicily. Nothing of any particular value grew there. It had no soaring cities. Its people, Christians who spoke a language derived from Arabic, were not rich. Very much the opposite. They were dirt-poor farmers and tenants on the estates of the rich, imported nobility, or fishermen pulling their living from the sea. But Malta had two things. First, a spectacular deep-water port called the Grand Harbor, a bay carved out of the island's rocky, dry, uneven coastline. And second, an absolutely vital strategic position smack dab in the middle of the Mediterranean. If the Hospitallers, at this point essentially clients of the Habsburg monarchs of Spain, retained control of Malta, then they could block any major Ottoman push into the western Mediterranean. But if the Ottomans could take the island, then they would have the perfect base for expansion. Sicily would certainly be doomed, and probably southern Italy as well. Beyond that, who could tell? And so Malta, the strategic hinge of the war for the Mediterranean, became the epicenter of the conflict that had been raging for the past half century or more. But why then? Why, in 1565, did the combined might of the Ottoman Empire turn toward Malta? The Christian chroniclers make the story a personal affair. One knight of St. John, a particularly daring corsair named Romegas, had made a nuisance of himself in the eastern Mediterranean for years. On one expedition in the summer of 1564, Romegas seized a large merchantman bound for Venice, loaded down with valuable luxuries. The ship had been financed by a high-ranking Ottoman official, who was understandably angry at losing his investment. On his next outing, that same summer, cruising off the coast of Anatolia, Romegas went further. He snapped up the governor of Cairo and the elderly woman who had nursed Suleiman's daughter. A few days later, Romegas captured the governor of Alexandria. By doing all this, Romegas had ruffled the feathers of the highest levels of the Ottoman elite in a very short period of time. The image the Christian chroniclers give us is one of Suleiman's daughter and the chief eunuch of the palace howling until an elderly, put-upon sultan just let them have the military expedition they wanted. This was enough, again, according to the Christian chroniclers, to turn the Hospitallers from an annoyance to a threat that demanded immediate attention. Now, that's a fun story. These kinds of complaints surely were a factor. Late in life, Suleiman was increasingly isolated, and the voices of those who could reach him, like his close family and palace eunuchs, did carry weight. But Suleiman hadn't survived 45 years on the Ottoman throne by being henpecked into launching major military expeditions. He knew what the Hospitallers were, a nuisance, not an existential threat. But he was also aware of what Malta represented in strategic terms. If the Ottomans could take the island, the Habsburgs and their allies would be on the ropes. The corsairs, like Hassan, would have free rein to pillage and plunder to their heart's content. And for good measure, the Sultan could win a great ideological victory by eliminating the Order of St. John once and for all. If you'll think back a couple of months to our episodes on the topic, Suleiman had actually begun his career as Sultan by launching an attack on the Knights when they were based in Rhodes. He had given them the option to leave, and leave they did. They went to Malta. Now, decades later, Suleiman meant to finish the job. By October of 1564, word began to filter out that the Ottomans were preparing an enormous expedition. Ottoman shipyards churned out supply vessels and war galleys all winter. The Janissaries trained with their long-barreled arquebuses, sharpening their already lethal aim for the task of picking off Hospitallers at a distance. Sipahi cavalry, who got land in return for military service, mustered from their rural holdings, pouring in from their estates in the Balkans and Anatolia. Grain, gunpowder, cannonballs, weapons, food, spare timber for siege vehicles. Porters loaded all of it into the holds of a now vast fleet. The Ottomans were nothing if not thorough. Everything had been carefully planned and decided beforehand. Engineers disguised as fishermen slipped onto Malta, measuring the walls and producing detailed plans and models of every fortification. All winter, the Ottoman engineers and commanders laid out their plans. Land here, build batteries there, take this fortification first. There were no illusions about the difficulty of the task. The knights had thoroughly modernized their defenses after a failed siege in 1551. All of those provisions were necessary because Malta itself couldn't provide them. There were no trees to use for siege towers and battering rams, no fields full of ripening grain that could supplement the soldiers' rations, nothing except rocks, dirt, and that wonderful grand harbor. Everything they needed would have to come with them, driven by the wind and oar over hundreds of miles of open sea. Even with the aid of the relatively nearby African corsairs, led by the formidable Turgut Reis, Malta was at the very edge of the possible range for an Ottoman fleet. And even for the finest siege experts of the era, a crown the Ottomans had earned many times over, conquering Malta would be difficult. For his part, Hassan spent the winter of 1564 in Tripoli with Turgut Reis, preparing for what was to come. Our friend was now almost 50 years old. More than 30 years at sea had taken him to every corner of the Mediterranean, from Istanbul to Algiers, Tripoli to Marseille, raiding villages near Valencia, capturing merchantmen off Genoa, fighting Venetian war galleys in the Adriatic. Hassan had done it all. Malta was familiar ground for him. He had passed it many times, keeping a wary eye out for a lurking Hospitaller galley, and he had landed there on two different occasions. As part of Turgut's fleet in 1551, he had helped enslave the entire population of Gozo, the other island near Malta. Trying to eliminate the Hospitallers wouldn't be an easy task, Hassan knew, but it would have to be done. Jean, ensconced in the small, rough castle of Birgu overlooking the Grand Harbor, was no less aware of what was coming than Hassan and Turgut. All the Christian powers, the knights included, had their sources of information in Istanbul. There was no hiding the scale of the preparations. Only a few targets were even plausible, and of those, Malta made the most sense. The Grand Master of the Order, an elderly Frenchman named Jean Parisot de Lavalette, made his own arrangements as winter died down and spring arrived. Letters went out all over Europe, calling the knights to Malta for the coming battle. More important than a few dozen noblemen, nowhere near enough to withstand the combined might of the Ottoman Empire, were the provisions and supplies the defenders would need to withstand a siege. Negotiations with Don Garcia de Toledo, the Viceroy of Sicily, and King Philip II of Spain's most important nearby subordinate, provided companies of professional soldiers to help man the fortifications. Among the soldiers who made the short voyage from Sicily to Malta was an aged Italian man of letters who had signed on as an arquebusier. Francisco Balbi di Correggio had seen a lot during his 60 years of life, a shockingly old age to be facing down the best of the Sultan's armies. Nothing he had seen would match the siege of Malta, and his account is an invaluable source for us to understand what happened. This is the true account of everything that happened from day to day in the siege, as I myself saw it, and I have written it down with complete accuracy, he wrote, with a great deal of modesty. Every day, Balbi took notes, scribbling down the major events of the day, which he later compiled into a narrative of striking detail, craft, and complexity. It's less a simple soldier's diary than a total history of the siege, and we're lucky to have it. And so Francisco Balbi trudged down the gangplank of a ship, sweating in the Maltese heat, and took in his new residence at the beginning of May 1565. He looked up at the bastions and seawalls protecting the peninsula of Birgu, a little town with the knight's headquarters and the castle of Fort St. Angelo at its center. 300 yards of open water, a little inlet where the knights kept their war galleys, separated the peninsula of Birgu from Senglea, another tongue of land projecting out into the Grand Harbor. Senglea, too, had its fortifications, a stout modern castle named Fort St. Michael. Across the harbor, perpendicular to Birgu and Senglea, was the high ground of Mount Skiberas. Looking down from the walls of Fort St. Angelo, wishing he were on one of the galleys bobbing at anchor instead of cooped up inside the walls, was Jean. If he couldn't be cruising the sea lanes of the Mediterranean on a galley, the knight thought, then Mount Skibidos would have been better than this. It commanded the harbor, and every one of the expensive military engineers who had visited Malta during Jean's time in the Hospitallers had recommended building a new stronghold for the knights there, instead of at Birgu. And yet all they had accomplished was placing a small fort, St. Elmo, to guard the position. None of the three forts, St. Elmo, St. Michael, or St. Angelo, had been completely finished when word of the Ottoman expedition arrived. Jean and his compatriots, but mostly the native Maltese and the knight's Muslim slaves, had spent the previous months feverishly working to prepare. They cut ditches, strengthened walls, added outer defensive works, and did everything they could to ready them for the coming onslaught. Soldiers trickled in. Spanish professionals, Italian mercenaries hired by the knights in Naples and elsewhere, all of them veterans who knew their business. The knights' galleys stopped passing ships in the channel near Malta and seized their provisions, stocking up for the inevitable attack. It was still nowhere near enough. Everybody knew it. But there was nothing else to be done. Like Hassan, Jean was now 50 years of age. He had spent his entire adult life fighting Muslims, mostly from the deck of a warship, but he would be perfectly happy to fight them here, too. He spat over the walls of Fort St. Angelo. His 2 years chained to the oar of a corsair galley before his ransom had left him with scars, missing teeth, and a thirst for revenge that no amount of pillaging and fighting could ever slake. Galleys or forts, in the end, made no difference. He knew how to aim a cannon, how to swing a sword, how to fight in armor. Let them come. If he died, he thought, he would simply be fulfilling the oaths he'd made so many decades before. On the morning of May 18th, 1565, Jean was standing on the battlements of St. Angelo, looking out toward the open sea to the southwest. His eyes weren't as sharp as they had been in years past, but he knew what the little fuzz of white close to the horizon meant. Sails, a lot of them, 30 miles distant. The Ottoman fleet had finally arrived, and the battle for the Mediterranean was nearing its climax.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Takeoff 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
The blast of one cannon, then another, marked the arrival of the Ottoman fleet. Malta flew into a flurry of activity. The Maltese villagers left behind their rocky fields and homes, fleeing for the safety of Medina, the island's landlocked capital city, and the knight's stronghold at Birgu. Jean watched from the battlements of Fort St. Angelo as they streamed in, columns of dust-covered peasants crowding the roads, chattering away in their strange language. Like most of the knights, Jean didn't think much of the Maltese. They were peasants, his natural inferiors, and foreign to boot. He didn't even believe they'd make a fight of it against the Ottomans. The tension was hard to bear. Jean and the rest of the knights were itching to fight as the Ottoman armada circled Malta, reconnoitering and looking for a safe place to land. News trickled in. A knight, a member of the Grand Master's household, given orders to observe the landing, had instead been captured. Jean knew he would be tortured. An Italian renegade fled to the knights and provided useful intelligence. The Ottomans numbered in the tens of thousands and were well-equipped with heavy siege guns. But the chain of command was confusing. Piyali Pasha commanded the fleet, Mustafa Pasha the land forces. Both were supposed to defer to the great corsair Turgut Reis when he arrived from North Africa. Who exactly was in charge? Who was making the important decisions? The Ottomans took their time coming ashore, landing in a bay several miles south of the Grand Harbor. It was all disciplined and orderly. 6,000 Janissaries in their tall hats hefting their long-barreled arquebuses, 9,000 Sipahis with their curved bows and swords but lacking their usual horses, thousands of irregular adventurers, some of them straight-up plunderers, others religious fanatics bent on holy war, who accompanied the professionals. Our friend Hassan and thousands more of the corsairs from North Africa would soon arrive with Turgut Reis. Now, the Ottomans knew their way around a siege. Nobody in the world was better at the intricate arts of heavy gunnery, mining, and the slow, meticulous work of digging trenches and emplacements. Malta would be a tough nut to crack. But if anybody could do it, it would be thanks to this combination of manpower and technical expertise. Against those 24,000 or so fighters, the Hospitallers could muster only 6,000 defenders, more than half of them native Maltese whose quality the knights, like Jean, doubted. Only 500 of them were actually knights. Another 1,800 were professionals, either Spanish or Italian, like Balbi di Correggio. If you were a betting person, you could have gotten great odds laying money on the defenders. The odds were long, but they weren't entirely hopeless. Jean and his compatriots had a few things working in their favor. The first, and most important, was that however accomplished the Ottomans were at siege warfare, in a basic sense, the tactical advantage in this age of warfare lay with the defender. The art of fortification had come a long way over the past century. Cannon had allowed the monarchs of the 15th century to blast their way through thin-walled castles and town defenses, but military engineers had quickly responded to these new trends. Walls were thicker and lower. They featured projecting bastions and outworks beyond the main defenses to provide additional fields of fire for cannon and arquebuses. Deep ditches, often more than one of them, soaked up cannon fire and presented yet another obstacle for the attackers. The solution to this basic disadvantage was patience, labor, technical skill, and most of all, time. Malta wasn't an impregnable stronghold by any stretch of the imagination, but the defenses had been built with these recent developments in mind. And that's where the other factors came in. Malta was a long way from the Ottoman heartland. Supplies were limited, they had to bring everything with them, and if anything new came up, they were more or less stuck. The island was too far away, the besieging army's supply lines too tenuous, and the logistical arrangements too fragile for the siege to last over the winter. On top of that, the longer they stuck around, the more likely it was that the powers of the Christian West, especially Philip II, the Habsburg King of Spain, would put together a relief force. An army could arrive on Malta and meet them in open battle, or a Christian galley fleet could cut them off from home. Sicily, which belonged to the King of Spain, was visible from Malta on a clear day. That was the perfect staging ground for a counterstrike. So this turned the siege into a race against time for both sides. The Ottomans had to blast the defenders into submission by September at the very latest. Philip II and his viceroy in Sicily, Don Garcia de Toledo, had to assemble a large enough land and sea force to challenge the Ottomans. Too small and too soon, and the sizable Ottoman forces, with ample time to dig in and pick the battlefield, would simply crush the relief effort and buy themselves more time for the siege. Too late, and the Ottomans would overwhelm the knights and secure a nearly impregnable stronghold for themselves, a gateway through which they could pour fresh troops and supplies. The Ottomans arrived on May 18th. That meant they had about 4 months to finish the job. Slowly, painfully slowly, the siege got underway. 3 days after the fleet was first sighted and finally disembarked, a large body of Ottoman soldiers made a demonstration in front of Birgu. Cymbals clashed, drums pounded, bugles and pipes wailed, a wall of sound that accompanied an Ottoman army. The sun glinted off the shining swords, shields, and armor of the soldiers. All of it was intended to frighten the defenders. The Grand Master, Jean Parisot de Lavalette, sent out a force of arquebusiers and knights to meet them. For the first time in the siege, the crash of handguns and the clangs of swords on armor echoed off the rocks of Malta. Our friend Jean was happy to get things started, sick of waiting, itching to fight. When he and his compatriots returned to their defenses, they were carrying a large number of Ottoman heads as trophies. In response, Mustafa Pasha, the Ottoman commander, had the French hospitaller who'd been captured a few days before beaten to death, very slowly, in full view of the ramparts. In the subsequent days, the Ottoman strategy became clear. They had plenty of targets to choose from. Medina, the inland capital, Fort St. Angelo and Fort St. Michael around Birgu and Senglea, where Jean was posted, or 500 yards away across the water, Fort St. Elmo, the little fortification on the other side of the Grand Harbor that commanded the vital anchorage. The Ottomans picked the last option, Fort St. Elmo, for exactly that reason. Take it, and their ships would have a safe place to shelter. Fail to do so, and an unseasonable summer storm might wreck the entire fleet. St. Elmo had only been built in 1552, after Turgut's last major assault on Malta. It was shaped like a star, as recent military engineering dictated, which gave the defenders good fields of fire. A high tower called a cavalier sat behind the main defenses. An outerwork called a ravelin protected the walls, and it had a deep stone-cut ditch in front. Its foundations were built on solid rock, so the Ottomans wouldn't be able to mine underneath it to collapse the walls. But the fort's stonework wasn't of great quality, and the siding of the angled walls wasn't quite ideal. Worst of all, St. Elmo sat right at the tip of a peninsula, and the heights of Mount Skibiras, further down toward the rest of the island, overlooked the whole fort. This meant that cannon and handguns could shoot down into the interior of the fort. Nobody on either side expected St. Elmo to hold for very long, but it might exact a high price in that time. A week after that first clash, the one in which Jean came back with the heads, the knight woke up to the deafening crash of Ottoman guns. Slowly and methodically, sappers had dug trenches all the way from the heights, 600 yards, down to the stone-cut ditch. They had also built earthen gun platforms to hold their siege cannon. By that time, Jean had already gotten used to the constant crackling of gunfire, Janissaries with their arquebuses hiding themselves in the rocky landscape, waiting for hours to get a shot at a target on the parapets of St. Elmo. Any time a defender showed his head, he risked getting it shot off. The snipers picked off 30 men in one day this way, and all the while, the trenches got closer and closer. A few days after that, on May 31st, the Ottomans bombarded the little fort day and night. Surely, it would soon fall. Or would it? Jean stood on the battlements on June 2nd, looking out across the water towards St. Elmo and taking in the dirty smudges of smoke from the guns and the fountains of dirt when a shot landed. He caught a glimpse of white sails on the horizon. Could it be a relief force from Sicily? Were they saved already? They were not saved. If anything, their situation had just gotten much, much worse. The newly arrived ships, 13 of them, had come not from Spanish Sicily, but from Algiers, the viper's nest where the corsairs made their lair. Our friend Hassan was among them, his galley riding low in the water, loaded down with corsairs ready to disembark and add their weight to the attack on Malta. More important than Hassan and a pack of corsairs, their arrival included the formidable Turgut Reis, who would hold overall command over the expedition. Almost 80 years old, with a lifetime of experience in all aspects of naval and siege warfare, Turgut was respected and feared across the Mediterranean. Upon arrival, Turgut reworked the siege of St. Elmo. He had been a gunner in his youth long before he'd ever stepped foot on a boat, and he hadn't forgotten the lessons of siege warfare. The old corsair ordered the construction of a new siege battery parallel to St. Elmo on another peninsula, which meant that the little fort was now under continuous bombardment from multiple angles. There was simply nowhere to hide. Hassan disembarked from his galley and rolled out his opulent tent, very near Turgut's, among the precisely ordered ranks of the Ottoman camp. He was much more accustomed to fighting at sea than on land, but he knew his way around a cannon, and this wouldn't be the first time he had led assaults on fortified positions. It wasn't as lucrative as swooping down on a rich merchantman, but he and his ruler Turgut were vassals of Suleiman the Magnificent. When Suleiman said go, they went. Despite the constant bombardment and sniping, St. Elmo held out for more than 2 weeks. The nights were filled with the firework glow of explosions and flame, visible to Jean some 500 yards away across the water, as little boats full of men and supplies crossed the Grand Harbor to reinforce the fort. Assault after assault after assault tried and failed to take the tiny fortification. Janissaries were set on fire by primitive incendiary devices fired from the walls. Jean and Hassan, watching the proceedings, saw the little torches of men alight with flame, but they were too far away to hear the screams. Still, the boats crossed the harbor, new forces arrived, and the corpses piled up on both sides. Then, the legendary Turgut, supervising the laying of a cannon towards St. Elmo, was mortally wounded by a shard of stone when it misfired. The Ottomans would no longer have his leadership to guide the siege. Finally, after weeks, the Ottomans succeeded in completely cutting off little St. Elmo. Hassan went back on board his galley and drew up close to the seaward walls, firing his cannon over and over and over again at the battered defenses. How could anyone be left alive in there, he wondered. They couldn't, not for much longer. Even across the expanse of the Grand Harbor, watching from Fort St. Angelo, Jean could hear the war cries when the Ottomans finally swarmed over the defenses and finished them off. The banner of St. Jean, white cross on red background, came down. Ottoman banners went up in their place. Hassan, laying just offshore, saw a haggard group of defenders come down close toward the water, out the back of the fortifications. He ordered his galley up close and took the prisoners on board. They might bring a fine ransom. Even in the heat of the siege, the profit motive still mattered for Hassan. The rest of St. Elmo's garrison perished to a man. The heads of the commanders were stuck on lances near a battery of cannon. Others were decapitated and nailed to wooden crosses. Still other corpses were tied to pieces of wood and floated across the water toward the still-living defenders on the other side of the harbor. Jean was there when they fished the bodies out of the water, some headless, others mutilated. In response, the Grand Master ordered all the Ottoman prisoners they'd taken removed from the dungeon and taken to the battlements. The enemy was watching when Jean and his comrades beheaded them. The next morning, the Hospitallers' guns fired not shot, but the decapitated heads into the Ottoman camp. Even for Hassan, who had spent his whole life engaged in more and less horrifying acts of violence, things were getting out of hand. Things were getting more and more vicious. It had taken the Ottomans more than 3 weeks to reduce the tiny fort of St. Elmo. Medina, the inland capital, still held out. So did Birgu and Senglea, with their forts St. Angelo and St. Michael, and some outer works. Taking little St. Elmo had cost at least 4,000 lives and huge amounts of powder and shot. No reinforcements were coming, and supplies were limited to what the corsairs of North Africa could provide. More importantly, at least from the perspectives of Mustafa and Piali Pasha, the two Ottoman commanders, now that Turgut was dead, the whole thing had taken far too long. Time was slipping away. They were running close to the edge of the possible.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With St. Elmo reduced to rubble and corpses, the Ottomans turned their attention toward the two remaining Hospitaller strongholds on the Grand Harbor. A pair of peninsulas, Birgu and Senglea, jutted out into the harbor, separated from each other by a narrow creek. Fort St. Angelo was the major defense on the tip of Birgu and the knight's headquarters. It protected the small town at its base, also called Birgu, but was stronger toward the sea than toward the land. Fort St. Michael sat at the choke point of Senglea, not at the tip of the peninsula, but its seaward defenses were lacking. There was a low wall and a strong point called the Spur facing out toward the harbor, but that was nowhere near enough to hold off a determined attack. Of the two, St. Michael was definitely the weaker, so Mustafa and Piali made the decision to take Senglea first. This would leave the knights isolated, surrounded, and vulnerable in their final stronghold. June bled into July. Jean heard the constant boom of Ottoman gunfire and watched from the battlements as the batteries on the heights pounded away at the walls of Fort St. Michael. He saw the Janissaries with their long arquebuses picking off defenders on the walls, and the hapless Muslim slaves chained together, forced to repair the damage done by the Ottoman cannon and dying for their trouble. One day, teams of Ottoman swimmers armed with hatchets dove into the water and tried to chop through the chain protecting the mouth of the creek between Birgu and Senglea. Jean cheered as Maltese swimmers fought them in the water. Raiding parties sallied forth from the garrisons, fighting vicious hand-to-hand encounters with the Ottomans in the trenches and dead ground in front of the defenses. For 3 full weeks this went on, the cannon roaring, the arquebuses crackling, shouts and screams. A full assault was coming, and everyone knew it. The Ottomans had decided on a 2-pronged strategy for taking Fort St. Michael. They would launch simultaneous attacks by land and sea, targeting the blasted land walls and the lacking seaward defenses at the same time. Jean, watching from Fort St. Angelo, could only be a spectator. But Hassan, not to mention old Francisco Balbi, the arquebusier/writer, would both have a front row seat. In the pre-dawn darkness of July 15th, just shy of 2 months into the siege, Hassan stepped into a large, oar-driven boat along with some 80 of the corsairs from his galley. Dozens of other boats surrounded them, all of them similarly laden with soldiers. Some of them other corsairs from Algiers, whom Hassan had known for years, others Janissaries in their tall white caps, still other Sipahis with curved bows and onion-shaped helmets protecting their heads. Bales of cotton and wooden shields piled up against the gunwales guarded them against the gunfire that was sure to come from the defenders. The water of the Grand Harbor lapped at the prow and the oars as the rowers quietly, quietly pulled the boats out into the darkness. Fires illuminated Fort St. Michael in the distance, which were soon joined by the rising glow of first light behind them. Looking down from the small fort at the tip of Senglea, Francisco Balbi saw what was coming, a small armada, thousands of soldiers. For a moment, everything was quiet. Then a wall of noise descended on the harbor. Drums, cymbals, horns, trumpets, imams reading aloud passages from the Quran, the cannon fire from the Ottoman guns pounding the landward walls, war cries from the men in the boats, still more from the thousands upon thousands starting to make their assault on Fort St. Michael in the distance. The guns on the seaward defenses opened up. Water showered down on Hassan in the front of his boat as the cannonballs splashed into the waves of the harbor. Screams erupted as shot ripped through a couple of the boats. Hassan caught sight of a wooden palisade projecting out into the water to stop the boats from running directly up onto the rocky shoreline. He could see arquebusiers aiming down, morning sunlight glinting off barrels and helmets and unsheathed swords. A huge crash of noise erupted from the land walls, gunfire and shouts. Another wall of noise as the simultaneous attacks began. Hassan's boat crashed into the palisade. It held firm. He leapt over the side of the boat into waist-deep water, waving his sword above his head, and his corsairs followed. The arquebusiers above, Francisco Balbi among them, opened up. Balls smacked into the surface of the churning water. Others hit flesh. All along the palisade, the attackers swarmed over the wooden barrier, reaching the rocks at the foot of the defensive wall. Rocks crashed down. Arrows and arquebuses returned fire. There were no longer any gaps between gunshots, just a constant roaring crackle punctuated by the blast of cannon and mortars. Incendiaries dropped down into the mass of attackers, setting their robes, turbans, and beards alight. Hassan's sleeve caught on fire from one of these jars of liquid fire as he tried to climb up the rocks. The skin on his arm bubbled and burned. He shrieked and fell back, felt his wrist and ribs break as he landed on the rocks of the shoreline, lost his sword, which had been a gift from Turgut Reis. Hassan managed to pull himself to his feet and plunged his burning arm into the sea, the wound searing as salt licked it. His boat was just there ahead, starting to pull backward, and he swam out and managed to clamber on board just before it departed into the harbor. He was just in time to see 10 more boats making for the tip of Senglea, part of the defenses that had seemed undefended and ripe for attack. The cream of the Ottoman forces were loaded into these 10 boats, and they somehow missed the battery of cannon waiting for them. At point-blank range, this battery of guns loosed a hail of grape shot, wiping out the attackers in an instant. Carnage marred the entire length of the shoreline. Bodies floated in the water behind Hassan. Some of them belonged to men he'd known for many years. Up against the base of the walls, he recognized a beautiful white turban, now stained red with blood, that he'd given to a lieutenant some years before. He couldn't bring himself to look at his arm, blistered and cracked and scorched black, silk melted onto the skin, but he knew it would be months before he was fit to fight again. For his part, Jean cheered the defenders from the battlements of Fort St. Angelo a few hundred yards away. The attack on the land walls had been stopped just as firmly as that on the seaward side. The failure of the assault on Senglea meant that a quick Ottoman victory was now completely out of the question. They would have to dig in, bombard, and do it all properly. Even more than before, this was now a race against time. The defenders' resilience against the resources of the attackers, with a promise of relief from Sicily hanging over everything. July wore on into August. The guns pounded away at both Birgu and Senglea, reducing the outer defenses to little more than rubble. Jean's nerves, the nerves of all the defenders, were close to shot. Finally, on August 7th, the Ottomans made another major assault. Jean and the Hospitallers knew it was coming. In the pre-dawn darkness, Jean had strapped on his armor and helmet, sharpened his sword, and made his way to the post of Castile, the outermost bastion protecting the peninsula of Birgu. He was there looking down when the usual cascade of noise that preceded an Ottoman attack erupted. Drums and cymbals clashed, the Janissaries' arquebuses crackled, arrows whistled overhead and smacked into the parapets. Barely illuminated, Jean saw a wave of soldiers rise up out of the trenches the attackers had slowly pushed forward over the prior weeks. Masses of men in white robes and turbans, white-capped Janissaries, sipahis in their steel helmets and chainmail, all of them howling at the top of their lungs. Jean waited for them. His mouth was dry. He felt his heart pounding in his chest and used his tongue to feel the gap in his teeth left so many years before by a corsair's fist. It was a nervous tic, something he did to calm himself in moments of great stress. If this didn't qualify, he didn't know what would. Time slowed down. Jean could make out individual faces, snarling mouths, even see the hairs of their beards. They carried brushwood and earth to fill up the stone-lined ditch at the base of the bastion. Arquebuses snapped and fired next to him, ramrods scraped in barrels as the gunners were loaded. He grabbed a grenade, lit the fuse, and tossed it down into the mass of men milling around the base of the bastion. It exploded, and a chorus of screams erupted. A ladder went up against the parapet, and Jean pushed it back down. The noise was overwhelming. The arquebusier next to him went down with an arrow in his forehead. That was when Jean saw the first soldier make it up onto the walls. It was a corsair, he thought, curved blade in hand. The man gutted a Maltese militiaman in the moment just before Jean took his arm clean off with a blow of his own sword. In the time it took Jean to finish him off with a thrust to the chest, two more attackers had come up in the corsair's place. A man wearing expensive-looking red silk stood on the lip of the parapet and waved his compatriots forward. Jean stabbed him through the leg, then took his head off with another sweep of his sword as he fell. An arquebus ball pinged off the side of Jean's open-faced helmet, knocking him senseless for just a moment. His sword fell out of his hands. When he came to, there was a Janissary on top of him, sliding a dagger through a gap in his armor. Burning pain erupted in his armpit. Jean felt down around his belt, pulling his own dagger out of a sheath, and desperately stabbed upwards once, twice, three times. The Janissary sighed and collapsed, lifeless, on top of him. As he got to his feet, still woozy and dripping blood from his armpit onto his armor, Jean grabbed his sword off the ground. The parapet of the outer defenses where he was posted was swarming with Ottomans. Their banners and flags waved from the wall. As far as he could tell, he was the last defender left here. An arquebus ball ricocheted off the top of the parapet and smacked against his breastplate, knocking him sideways with the force of it. His ears barely seemed to work, so loud were the explosions of bombs and the roar of cannon and the shouts of wounded and dying men around him. He barely got his blade up in time to block the overhand chop of a sipahi's sword. It was pure luck that the man slipped in a puddle of blood and fell off the wall. Jean wasn't so lucky with his next assailant. When Jean knocked aside a blow of his sword, the man slammed the rim of his shield into the knight's face. Jean felt his nose break with the impact. The second blow shattered his jaw. The third knocked him unconscious, and the roar of battle around him faded into nothingness. When Jean woke up, The midday sun was beating down on his face. Blood caked his nose, lips, and forehead. He discovered that he couldn't move. There was a body on top of his legs. It belonged to the man with the shield who had bludgeoned him into unconsciousness. He had a neat hole in his forehead, the product of an arquebus shot. Jean managed to kick him off and pulled himself to his feet. There were knights and soldiers around him. One of them was the Grand Master himself, aged, elderly, his beard white, holding a broken pike in his hands. The cannon still roared, but it all seemed so very far away. The world turned black, and Jean collapsed again, barely alive. His siege, like Hassan's, was over. The pulverizing bombardment and skirmishing carried on for another month, and so did the siege. The Ottomans made several more desperate attacks at the end of August, even as the weather turned to blustering gales and rain, and a relief force made sail from Sicily. A week later, on September 7th, help finally arrived in numbers. By chance, the Ottoman galleys, Hassan's among them, had been called away from watching for the fleet from Sicily to prepare for one final attempt to take Birgu and Senglea. The Christian fleet, by pure luck, sailed right into the gap they had left behind, disembarked 10,000 men, and returned to sea. There was nothing else to be done but leave. The Great Siege of Malta was over. But the war itself, the war for the Mediterranean, was not. It dragged on and on and on over the coming years. When his many wounds healed, the 50-year-old Jean put back out to sea with his galley, raiding and pillaging the sea lanes of the east once again. Hassan's arm bore terrible scars and never fully healed, but he too was still in his prime. There was one final climax to reach. In 1570, 4 years after Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent finally passed away, the Ottomans reopened their centuries-long conflict with the Republic of Venice. The Venetians still held the large island of Cyprus, just off the coast of Anatolia, and this was the main target of the war. For an entire year, the Ottomans besieged the capital city of Famagusta. Meanwhile, the Venetians called out for aid from the Christian world. It took a long time, far too long to save the Venetians holed up in Famagusta, but eventually a Holy League, backstopped by the Pope and Philip II of Spain, came into being to take the fight to the Ottomans. It was a fragile thing. Spanish and Italian soldiers, Venetian ships, Genoese adventurers, and of course, the Knights of St. John. No group in the alliance was especially fond of any other. The Christian fleet that assembled in September of 1571 was of unprecedented size. 208 galleys, 6 Venetian galleasses armed with heavy cannon, 24 other ships, and 26,000 soldiers. Our friend Jean was there in his galley, now 56 years old, his enjoyment in riding the waves practically undimmed even after decades of blood. From Sicily, the fleet headed east, cruising along the coast of Greece looking for the Ottomans. They soon found them. Our friend Hassan was there with a squadron of galleys, as were all the major corsairs of North Africa. The stage was set for one final battle for control of the sea. It happened at Lepanto, on the coast of Greece, on a lovely autumn day, October 7th, 1571. By luck, both sides had underestimated the other's numbers and their will to fight. Neither really thought there would be a battle. But those false assumptions drove them into one of the largest naval battles in history. Some 600 ships in total, 140,000 men, came together. Hassan was on the left wing of the Ottoman fleet, out toward the open sea. Jean was closer to the center of the Christian line, near the flagship. The two lines crashed together in an unspeakable melee. Everything obscured by the smoke of fire and cannon and arquebus, the air rent with the splintering of wood and the endless screams and yells. The two flagships collided. The Ottoman commander, Ali Pasha, fell dead. A Spanish soldier hacked off his head and raised it like a trophy. The Ottoman line began to break. Jean had already fought for much of the day, boarding two different Ottoman galleys and fighting his way across blood-soaked decks. Hassan, by contrast, had not seen any fighting. His wing, commanded by the corsair king Uluç Ali, a renegade like himself, had stood well off toward the open sea, looking for an opportunity at a flanking maneuver. Now, with the battle drawing to its end, their chance came. Following hard behind Uluç Ali, Hassan's galley drove toward a battered-looking ship flying the banner of a white cross on a red background. A galley belonging to the Knights of St. John. It was Jean's vessel, already blasted with holes from Ottoman guns, most of its mercenary soldiers and full knights wounded or dead. As they closed to within spitting distance, Hassan's archers and arquebusiers raked the galley with fire. Jean, with his distinctive white cross on his surcoat, might as well have been wearing a target. He fell dead, riddled with arrows and arquebus balls. Ulugh Ali, our friend Hassan, and the rest of the corsairs escaped practically unscathed, leaving behind a ruined collection of Hospitaller, Genoese, and Venetian galleys. But this was one tiny victory amid a crushing defeat. Much of the Ottoman fleet had been destroyed, leaving thousands upon thousands of corpses bobbing in the sea amid a tangle of broken timber, flames, and the indescribable flotsam and jetsam of battle. The Holy League's fleet had been mauled. Jean had paid the price. But there was no doubting who had won. At least for now, the Habsburgs had come out ahead victorious. One chapter of the long war was over. And so too is this topic on our show. For all of you who have listened to our episodes on the early modern period, thank you. We'll have a few interviews coming up over the following weeks as we gear up for our next topic. And when scripted episodes return later next month, we'll be heading to prehistory. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound design is by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Leah Sutherland and Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.